Thank you so much. And thank you all for being here. I thought there might only be the other 65 Al-Anons. My name is Alex B. I am from Matthews, North Carolina, which a lot of you probably don't know where that is. It's just a suburb of Charlotte, so I'm from Charlotte. Thank you so much for having this conference. Thank you for to the committee for having me here. Thank you to all the other speakers. It's been a joy, Belinda, to hear you last night, share your recovery with us, and this morning, Rachel. It's always wonderful seeing another young person in the program, and I took a lot from what she had to say. I was actually inspired by what she said about going to a meeting as a newcomer and hearing other people share what it feels like, what their drinking was like for me going to an Al-Anon meeting, to hear people talk about what they're feeling on the inside. A lot of us talk about like recovery and how much we love recovery, but you know, when I came into the rooms, I didn't know what that was. I didn't know what serenity was. I didn't know what talking about any of that was. So, you know, I'd like to return to that today to tell you how I feel on the inside and how I felt on the inside for my entire life and how it's been changed by the program of recovery and the program of Al-Anon. Because, you know, for our AA members, you might not think that you relate to an Al-Anon. I have been fortunate enough to be around the rooms of AA since I was 9. And I continue to go to open AA meetings because on the inside, I'm the same. You know, I have the same thoughts and feelings and inadequacies and character defects and, you know, cycles that I continue in. You know, members at my local open AA meeting that I went to were like, "How's your sobriety going?" And I was like, "No, I don't. I'm not an alcoholic." And they were like, "Keep coming back." I was like, "No, really, I'm not." I mean, like, thank you, but no. I have a home group. It's the One Purpose Al-Anon Family Group. It's in Charlotte, and we meet on Thursday nights at 8 p.m. We are a hybrid meeting, so if you'd like to join on Zoom, please feel free, or if you're in Charlotte, let us know. I'll give you the information for that. We always love to have new members come to our meeting. I have a sponsor. I'm fortunate enough to have had a sponsor for the majority of my recovery, and that sponsorship has been a gift to my life, to have that unconditional love come from another human being. That was one of the first times I'd ever experienced that, was having a sponsor. And in Al-Anon, we don't really have sobriety dates. I came into the program in February of 2008. We don't have, like, emotional sobriety dates, because that would be this morning. And that's not an original by me. I can't claim that. I've heard that a few times in the rooms. And I've said it a few times in the rooms, too, and usually I'm just sort of like, yeah, what was that? It was whatever. It was probably something that drove me nuts. No, like, I woke up to a text from the person. We have a district meeting, and I'm the GR for my group, but I wasn't able to be there, obviously, because I'm here. And the person who was taking over for me was like, "I don't have any information." I was like, "Oh, my God, I have to take care of all of this. You know, the world is going to end if I don't orchestrate this." It's God's plan. It's not mine. I just forgot that for a moment at 8:15 this morning. I'm really grateful to be here. I'm going to share a bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, because it's all I know and it's all I can do, and I know that at a certain point God will kick in. Before this, a wonderful gentleman behind me offered to let me have some time to myself and didn't have to stand in line to get a coffee, and I was like, I can't have enough time with myself in my head before I get up here, or God won't have any room in here to step in. I can't think too hard about it. So my story starts off when I was born, as most do, because as far back as I can remember, every day that I woke up, I felt out of place in this world. As far back as I can remember, I didn't know who I was supposed to be, whether I was supposed to be here, what I was supposed to think, feel, or do. And every day I woke up, it felt a little bit like agony to know that I didn't know if I was supposed to be here, if I was supposed to fit in. Which, as far back as I can remember, is like 3 years old. I didn't know what to do with that at 3 years old. I grew up in the disease of alcoholism. I am the product of an alcoholic father and a mother who is an adult child of an alcoholic, who was an adult child of an alcoholic, who was an adult child of an alcoholic. So I come by this very naturally. Alcoholism has permeated every part of my life, the way that I think, feel, understand the world, relate to other people, have family relationships, have friendships, have, you know, any ways that I interact with people has been affected and built by the disease of alcoholism. I'm grateful to be here. It is easy to speak with all of you because I love being around alcoholics. I love being around alcoholics. I sleep a little better when they're sober alcoholics. but I love being around all of you. It's one of the few places where I don't feel like I am I'm misplaced in the world. It's one of the only places where I feel like I belong. I grew up in alcoholism, and I knew fairly young that my father was an alcoholic, that he used to be an alcoholic, and that he went to AA, and then you guys fixed him, and now he could drink again. I found that out at a young age, and I didn't know what that meant. I knew that alcohol was in our house constantly. Alcohol was another member of our family. We had wine decor. We had like the border wallpaper that goes around the ceiling that was wine themed. We had wine themed floor mats. We had wine racks, and we went on trips to vineyards, and I could identify different types of wine and their quality by smell when I was a young kid. I was around 4 or 5. And I didn't know that there was anything wrong with that. I didn't know anything different outside of my house. I'm an only child. These are some relevant facts. I'm an only child. I am not always great at making friends, and I wasn't when I was a kid, definitely. I was homeschooled, and so I really didn't know anything outside of my family. It was me, my mom, and my dad, and my grandmother came to live with us when I was around 7, and all I knew were those people. All I knew was the four walls of my home, and I didn't know if there were, what normal meant. I didn't know if other people's families were like this. I didn't know if my experiences were shared, and all I could think is when I knew that the world felt crushing, I knew that, you know, I didn't know what to do, or I didn't know if my family was acting the way that they were supposed to act. There was some voice inside me that said, there has to be something better than this. There has to be. And I don't know how to find it. And I don't know if it's meant for me, but there has to be something better than this. And now I know that that was the voice of my higher power speaking to me, that there is something better than this. And that I found it when I got to the rooms. Alcohol was another member of our family, and I knew how it affected my parents, and I knew the ways that I was supposed to react when it affected my parents. Alcohol did not seem like a problem. When my father drank, he seemed to like me more, and I liked him more. He wanted to spend time with me. He wanted to play with me when he was drinking. He seemed funnier. He was more apt to talk to me when he was drinking, and when he wasn't, he didn't seem like he wanted to have anything to do with me. My mother drank along kind of with my father. It was like a whole, it was a family experience. I knew how to take care of my parents when they passed out in my room. I knew how to take care of my parents when we actually just recently had a very dear family friend ask if my mother and I have an agreement that if I'm out and I'm too drunk to come home, that I can call her and she will come pick me up. And we looked at each other in confusion because no, like, I've come to pick my parents up when they were drinking too much, but that's not the other way around. I am fastidious in the ways that I take care of my affairs. Thank you very much. I grew up taking care of people. That was the only place where I felt I had a use, I had a purpose, was when I was taking care of other people, emotionally, physically, spiritually. I knew that I had a right to be in their life if I was able to take care of them. If I was able to take care of my parents when they were drinking, when they were just fighting, whatever it may be, if I could take care of them, I knew that I had a reason to be there. I did not have the experience of mom and dad meet each other and they fall in love and they get married and then magically a baby happens and now I'm here. That was not my experience. My parents met and they dated for a little while and then I happened. And they weren't necessarily intending to stay together, but I happened. And I carried around with me the weight of feeling like my parents, who very obviously did not like each other from what I observed as a child, were only together because of me. They were only together because I happened. And I wasn't supposed to happen, and yet I was. And so I carried around this feeling that I was a mistake, not just by my parents, but that my very existence was. I didn't grow up with religion, so the idea of God was sort of like, yeah, he's there, but like none of my business, really. But deep down, it was whatever created me, whatever power created existence, created human life, made a mistake by bringing me here. And in the rooms, I've learned that that's not the case. I'm not a mistake. God did not make a mistake by putting me here. There's a reason that I'm standing here talking to you guys, and I don't know what that is, but I believe it's about growing along spiritual lines. To carry on this mistake, this feeling of being a mistake, taking care of my parents, everything like that, I didn't think I had a problem, of course. I knew that there was a problem in my house. I knew that there was a problem. I didn't think that it was alcohol. I didn't think it was my father. He was emotionally inaccessible, but, you know, whatever. I mean, like, He didn't really talk to me very much, but that wasn't a problem. I knew what the problem was. The problem was my mother. Because she was insane. I knew that that was the case. And she would get mad at my father for drinking, and I didn't see the negative effects of my father's alcoholism. I only saw the things that were assets to me. And so when my mother got angry at my father for drinking, I was upset because I said, why are you taking away the one thing that makes my father love me? Why are you upset at him for this thing that makes him nicer to people and makes him laugh more and talk to us more? I didn't understand the effects that having an alcoholic spouse can have. I didn't know those adult issues that they were facing, that they weren't sharing with me. That wasn't my priority at the time. I didn't understand that the way that alcoholism affected another individual meant that my mother was not able to be the parent that I had wanted or expected, because she was dealing with so much on her own. As a child, I thought that the entire world revolved around me, even though I felt like I wasn't supposed to be in the world. It was a dichotomy, okay? Like, I didn't know how that worked, but I did walk through the world thinking that everybody was judging me, criticizing me, thinking that I should have been better, and that they were just paying attention to me. I did think, waking up this morning, I found out I forgot socks, and I did think that the one comment I was going to get today from every single one of you was that I'm wearing the wrong socks. Nobody cares. It's a tremendous lesson I've learned. Nobody cares. But as a child, I was anxious. I was anxious all the time that other people were thinking about me, what they were thinking about me, that they were saying I was not good enough. I felt like I was not good enough for my parents. I was not good for anybody that met me. But my mother was insane. And I also loved my mother more than anything, more than I could stand in my body. My mother was the center of my universe. The sun rose and set on my mother. She was everything to me. She taught me what love meant, and she taught me that there was one other person on this planet who just wanted me here so badly. At the same time, my mother taught me what fear was. My mother taught me what it was to be afraid of somebody that I'm very close to, that's what it means to be close to somebody, is that I'm afraid of them. I have a word now for the relationship that my mother and I had, and that's emotional abuse. I had no idea what was in store every time that I spoke with my mother. I was able to pick up after a while on the way that her car pulled into our driveway. We have a gravel driveway, and I could tell by the speed with which she pulled into the driveway what mood she was in and whether I needed to go hide, because I didn't know what her reaction was going to be like. I didn't have an understanding of what consequences would arise from my actions. There were times that I would take certain actions and nothing would happen, and other times I did things that I didn't even know was wrong, and I was getting screamed at, berated. There was aggression in my house, but there was not physical abuse. There were, you know, things thrown, doors kicked, and so there was a violent energy. And there was not physical abuse to me, but there was always the fear. I didn't know anything different between kicking a door, kicking the dog, and kicking me. I didn't know. So I constantly lived in fear of being the subject of that. I lived in fear of anger. And I took to heart all the words that were said to me out of what I now know to be the effects of alcoholism. I took those to heart, and I thought that defined who I was. I didn't know anything different. But I didn't think that I was having any problems. I was fairly sure that I was fine. Let me describe to you how I felt at, let's say, around 9. All right, this was everywhere from between 4 and 9. I was anxious constantly. I was depressed. I was depressed at a very young age. I didn't understand what it meant to feel just joyous and free. That wasn't my reality. I was anxious. I was sad. I was constantly thinking about others and whether or not they were going to be okay, whether or not they were going to get sick and die. No reason. They were doing fine. But what if they got sick and died? What if they crashed the car on the way home? What if, you know, they don't want me to be here? I tried to run away several times because I thought that they didn't want me to be here. I was a burden to them. I didn't know whether I was supposed to be interacting with other people my age, if they would even relate to me. I didn't think that their problems had anything to do with mine, because I was worried about my parents and their adult problems. And, you know, what is our financial situation like? How is my parents' relationship going? Is that okay? Is there something that I can do to fix it? Of course, there wasn't anything I could do to fix it, but I was constantly thinking about these. If not, I was trying to escape somehow. I was trying to escape reality somehow. I was trying to, you know, dive into books or video games or whatever it was. I was trying to escape from this feeling I had that I wasn't supposed to be in my skin. But I didn't have any problems, of course. When I was 9, there was a conflict between my parents about my father's drinking, and basically he was having some health problems, and my mother suggested that maybe he should try not drinking, see if that affects that, and he didn't like that very much. And he returned to AA, and fortunately has been sober ever since. I am blessed that for the majority of my life now, both of my parents have been in recovery. We have all been in recovery. We have... Our family is a house of recovery. Of course, that doesn't mean that things are perfect. There have been times and meetings that people say, you know, it must be so wonderful that you all are in recovery and just things just go so well. No. We drive each other nuts. That's how it goes, because we're family, and that's how it is. We know one another's buttons. We made them, we put them there, and we know exactly how to find them and where to push them. It's just that there's sobriety in our house now, and we have more articulate ways of doing it. My mom went to Al-Anon shortly after my father went into AA, and she brought me to Alateen, which I did not understand, because I thought, okay, she has a problem with the alcohol, and the alcohol is gone because Dad is going to AA. I don't like that because now he's really upset all the time. But, you know, the alcohol is gone. Whatever. Mom went to Al-Anon. Okay, so both of the problems have taken care of themselves. Everything is going to be great now. I am no longer going to feel like I do on the inside. Everything is going to be great now. Our family is going to be wonderful and loving. We're going to be normal, whatever normal is. I don't know what that is, but, you know, we're going to be normal. And it didn't happen. But my mother took me to Alateen and said, get in the car. And I did everything Mom said, so I got in the car. And I went to Alateen, and I didn't know how to interact with other people my age. I walked into the room and saw other kids and wanted to walk right back out again. I was terrified. I figured I wasn't going to relate to them. They weren't going to like me. They were going to judge me. They were going to think that I wasn't supposed to be there. And I didn't want to have anything to do with that. I thought everybody was judging me constantly. And so I sat in that room and I did not listen and I did not talk. I had the capacity to sit in a room for hours when other people are talking and not hear a single word that they're saying. You know, I am plagued with this obsession with self. That's one of the reasons that I love coming to open AA meetings, because I have to remember that at a very base level, I'm extremely self-centered. I'm extremely self-centered. And it causes me to act in irrational ways. It causes me to be dishonest with other people and to tell other people that I am certain things when I'm not. It causes me to tell other people that they are certain things when they are not. It causes me to tell other people that situations are certain ways when they're not. I'm obsessed with the way that I am and the way that I see the world. And so I stayed obsessed with my self-centeredness and all of the racetracks in my head that, you know, there were thoughts that were just running in circles over and over again, not productive, all in the past or the future. I didn't listen to anything. I did this for a few weeks, and eventually I got bored of just sitting there and not talking and not listening. And so there was a little bit that trickled in from what other people were saying. And it was shocking because they had words for the ways that I was feeling. I didn't have words for how I felt. I didn't understand emotions. There were kind of assigned emotional roles in my family. My mother was anger. That was her job. That was what she was allowed to do. My father, I never really knew what he was allowed to do, but he was sad a lot of times. He was resentful a lot of times, and I figured I could take sadness also. There was enough room for more sadness in the house. And I carried a lot of guilt and shame. Wherever I went, I carried sadness, guilt, and shame. Those were the things that I knew how to do. And I didn't even have words for those. I just knew it was everything that was going on in here. So when I went to an Alateen meeting and people were talking about how they felt, that got through to me. They had words for those things. You know, they had words for that agony that I felt, that constriction in my chest every time I woke up, and I knew I didn't know what was happening for the rest of the day, but I figured it was probably going to be bad, and it was probably going to be out of my control, and I was probably going to feel helpless about whatever was happening that day, all of that, as soon as I woke up, and they had words for that. And they said that it doesn't have to be like that forever. And it satisfied that voice in me for just a moment that said there has to be something better, because they were there and they said, yes, there is something better. There is something better, and you don't have to wait until you grow up and you move out of your parents' house before you can have that feeling of it's getting better. You don't have to wait until, you know, someone miraculously comes and takes you away before you're able to feel like that. You can feel like that right now. And that was really, really interesting to me, because I thought that wasn't something that was going to be available to me. So the next week I showed up and I listened a little bit more, a little bit got in through the constant narrative of myself that was running through my head all the time. And then as I continued going, I learned more and more. I heard the sponsors. Alateen sponsors are incredibly important to our program, because they were adults who were responsible, who were kind to me. They were unconditionally loving, and they never judged or they were never abusive to me in any kind of way. They never said unkind things. They never did unkind things to me. And that was the first time I'd come across an adult like that. It was the first time I come across somebody who created a safe environment where it was okay to be who I was, and that they valued me just for being there. I didn't have to do anything for anyone. I was valuable just for being there. And to accept that love, I just soaked it up like a sponge once I realized that it was there, once I was able to listen to others. And eventually I did share about how I felt on the inside, and it just came pouring out, because I hadn't been able to share anything about what was going on in my household with anybody. And so to be able to pour that out with people who seemed to understand was priceless. And for people not to go, either that's weird, and I don't know why you're experiencing that, or B, that's your fault. Nobody said that. I thought they were going to look at me and say, that's what you deserve. And nobody said that. And instead they welcomed me and they said, we're glad you're here, and we need you to keep coming back. And so I did continue to do that. I stayed in Alateen all the way up until I aged out. You age out at 20, 21? I stayed in until around 18. I made the transition to Al-Anon. It was not perfect the entire time. I did dive into Alateen with service and starting my steps. Service as a young, a young person. We're young people now, but as a child, service was excellent, because I don't know if you've ever been 10 in a room full of 55-year-old women. I was a celebrity. I was GR for my group, and I went to an assembly with, you know, everybody in the state. They were obsessed with me. And it was quite wonderful, because, first of all, it was an ego boost, and I always love an ego boost. But also, there was a room full of nice adults. There was a room full of adults who were being nice to me, and they were just happy that I was there. And that was wonderful. Like, wow, there are people in the world who can appreciate me just for being here. How amazing is that? And so I continued being involved in service. It also helped me to feel like I had a purpose, a reason to be there without having to take care of another person. There was a significance to me being there in the room because I represented my group. I was able to make some choices without having to control everything. I was not able to control everything. But I was there and I had value. And I was going through my steps. Step one, I'm powerless over everything. Yeah, that works. My sponsor said, I wasn't understanding the first step at first, and she said, all right, I want you to make a list of everything that you are afraid of. And I was typing an email, and so she was like, make a list of everything that you are afraid of. And I was typing for a while, and I was like, I gotta tell you, this email's never gonna end. I'm never gonna stop writing. I am afraid of everything. Everything. I walk through the world afraid of everything. And that was the lesson of it. I'm walking through the world afraid of everything because I am powerless over all of it. And that feeling of powerlessness is terrifying, because when I wasn't powerless over things, I knew that I was in danger. When I didn't have any power over anything, I knew that everybody I loved was in danger. The world was going to fall apart. There was nothing holding it together if I was not holding it together at the tender age of 7. I couldn't deal with the powerlessness, and so I became obsessed with trying to, you know, manage others, control others. So when I accepted that I was powerless, I did not like that feeling. I have heard, you know, many experiences where people were relieved by step one. I was not relieved by step one. I was scared out of my mind by step one. I felt extremely uncomfortable after step one, because I thought, if I am powerless, what's going to happen? The world is going to fall off kilter. You know, I have no way of understanding that it's going to be okay. And that's when my sponsor said, well, that's what step two is for, is that I am powerless, but that doesn't mean that everything is going to fall apart. There is a power greater than myself. And I thought, yes, of course, there is a power greater than myself. That is my mother. I know that there's a power greater than myself. And it's like, no, there's a power greater than all of us. I had a habit of making other people my higher power. I thought that if there was somebody who was an authority figure, they were my higher power for the moment, and I could rely on that person. The problem with that is that human beings are fallible. You know, human beings are not perfect. And so I was believing in someone and something and believing everything that they said, and they were not perfect. And so I thought that my understanding that there was good in the world was not perfect. And to turn that to a power greater than all people helped me a lot with this constant feeling of instability, because God doesn't make mistakes. God is not fallible. God is not going to tell me that I'm wrong because he woke up on the wrong side of the bed that morning. God is not going to drop the ball in taking care of me. That's not something I have to fear with my higher power. And that took some getting used to. I didn't understand what that meant. As I said, I didn't grow up with religion, and so I'm very grateful I didn't have to unlearn anything about religion. But I also never really had this idea that God cares about me. I thought that God cared about people who went to church, but I didn't think that God cared about me because he had no reason to. So for me to understand a higher power that exists everywhere, I had to turn to unconventional things. I heard somebody in a meeting say, my higher power is a lamp. And I like that, the idea that a higher power is not some, you know, Santa Claus in the sky, but that God is in nature. God made trees, God made the ocean, because a person didn't make that. And I can believe in that. I moved on to step three, turning my will and my life over to the power that I had just come to believe in. And what did that mean? It meant turning over my thoughts, feelings, and actions over to this higher power. I didn't understand my thoughts, feelings, and actions. I didn't know how I could turn them over because I didn't know what they were. I didn't know where they came from or why they existed. And as I grew to observe what I was doing and maybe why I was doing it, I was like, okay, well, that doesn't make sense. So that can probably go to God. That also doesn't make sense. So we can probably go to God too. And I found that a lot of things that I was doing didn't make sense if I looked at them. And when I went into my step four, that was one of the things that I wanted to understand. I wanted to know, why am I doing the things that I'm doing? It's the same way that when my father was drinking or when my mother was just raging, I didn't understand why they were doing the things that they were doing, because the disease of alcoholism, cunning, baffling, powerful, was bigger than anything I could make sense of. And its effects on me were also bigger than anything I could make sense of. When I went into my step four, I did the best that I could. I was 10. There were only so many things I'd experience. I could remember all of them, you know. You know, my step four was pretty minimal, but I did the best that I could. I didn't know how to be super honest about what was going on inside. I was as honest as I could be, but honesty was still something that was in the works. I learned to be dishonest at a very young age. And it was not just about lying, which I did become a very good liar. I got punished quickly for lying, and so I just learned to be better at lying so that I didn't get punished. But I learned to be dishonest with myself and others about who I was. Because I figured that who I was not anything that anyone wanted to have anything to do with. And so I became a people pleaser. I did become whatever I thought the other person wanted of me. I could change the way that I walked, talked, acted, sounded in order for the other person to accept me a little more. Or so I thought. I didn't think that anybody would want me as exactly who I was. So I was as honest as I could be. I moved on to step five, and I shared, you know, that with my sponsor and understood it myself to some degree, shared it with my higher power, because I was like, well, God's watching everything. God knows this. Okay, all right. Moved on to step six, and that is where I hit a wall. I hit a wall at step six, because my character defects were all that I knew. I did not think there was anything left to me except for character defects. And so for God to be ready for God to remove these character defects, I didn't think there would be anything left. I did not think that there would be anything left. And I didn't know how to let go of that. How do I let go of something that has defined my entire life? And so I just like went on a hiatus from the steps. I was like, not happening. I still continued to go to my meetings. The fellowship was extremely important to me. It was my rock in times of some extreme struggle and turmoil. I got to 13. And as Rachel shared this morning, being a teenager sucks. Being a teenager is really bad. I don't know how much any of you remember being a teenager, but it's really bad. And I was dealing with these feelings that I had growing up in alcoholism that were finally thawing, right? Like, they were finally getting a little bit unlocked because I was, you know, getting a little looser with talking about who I was, my experiences with other people who were not judgmental, and all these waves of anger that I had compressed for years because I had decided that I was never going to be angry because angry people hurt people and they are bad. That's what I learned of anger. So I am never going to experience anger because if I am angry, I will hurt people and I will be bad. And so, but that obviously didn't stop the anger. And so when it was finally coming to the surface, I thought I was going to explode. I thought I was going to drop dead because of this sheer amount of emotion that was in me all the time. And of course, you know, know, hormones were hitting my body at the time. And, you know, these waves of sadness and physically feeling the fear that I had experienced as a child growing up that I had just internalized. This fear of walking around in my body and not knowing if I was going to face violence, if I was going to face just being berated at the moment's notice. All of that was coming forward and it felt strange because my circumstances were not like that anymore. It was like that in my head, but it was not like that in my life. You know, both my parents were in recovery. It wasn't magical. You know, my parents were working on themselves. I was working on myself. But my circumstances, to a large degree, were predictable. And to have all these feelings of chaos coming up was overwhelming. Decide is a strong word. I went out to walk out my character defects so that maybe I could get a little bit better at releasing them. This was not conscious at all. This is looking back. I needed to go practice my character defects a little bit so I had something I need to let go of. And a little bit longer of like an amends list in order to like actually have a step 9 to go back to. So I also went into public school around this time. And I've been homeschooled for the majority of my time, and then I went in public school. I was awkward, and I didn't know what to do, and I didn't know how to interact with other people. But what I did know is the rules of my family, and I knew how to find other people who reminded me of my parents. And so I went out and I sought out people who reminded me of my parents because I knew how to take care of them. I knew how to manipulate them. I knew how to, well, we have four M's in Al-Anon: manipulate, manage, manipulation, managing, martyrdom, and mothering. Not in that order. I practiced all of those because I knew how to practice all of those with people. And I sought out other people who were dysfunctional and reminded me of that feeling. And as a result, my life became unmanageable again. It became extremely unmanageable. I found friendships that were chaotic and unstable, where I constantly felt like I was saving people. I found I started dating people, and I didn't know what to do with that, but I knew how to take care of other people and mother them. And in school, I was very depressed. Mental illness is a big part of my experience. I was depressed as long as I can remember. Suicidal ideation was a big part of my story. I first wanted to kill myself at 10, and it just got worse. And the reason that I share that is because it was because I felt I did not belong, and I was constitutionally, fundamentally alone, and that I wasn't supposed to be here. And that changed when I had a spiritual awakening in the program, and a turning point where it was no longer on the table. That's no longer on the table for me. It had been on the table for me as long as I can remember. And then I realized that in this program that I have a reason that I'm supposed to be here. And that's not going to change. And things aren't necessarily easier. Life continues. Life has its ups and downs. But that's not on the table for me anymore because I have value and I have a reason that I need to be here. And that is a miracle. I never thought that was going to be the case. I was struggling with a lot of mental illness at the time, practicing my character defects, and things became gradually more and more unmanageable. I was continuing to go to my meetings, but I figured, they don't have anything for me anymore. All right, Alateen, even though the word teen is in the title, they're not going to have anything to do with my problems. You know, I'm having these unique problems. Again, this self-centeredness, I thought that I was the only person in the world who was dealing with this. I was not. A lot of people around me were, and if I was able to listen to them, maybe I would have heard it. But maybe this was just the experience I needed to have. When I was around 17, it got to this tipping point. I felt like I had put all these plates spinning on sticks in the air, and I was trying to juggle all of them, and it was a constant rush to like catch them before they fell off, and then they were just crashing to the ground around my ears. I felt that everybody that I had accumulated in my life hated me and thought I was scum of the earth. They were calling me a monster and that I didn't deserve to love anybody, and they were situations I had put myself in. They were dynamics that I had created because they reminded me of the dysfunction that I had learned. That was my base rules for interacting with the world. And so I realized when it got to a tipping point, I found myself routinely at the top of parking garages and you know, not wanting to be here anymore. I knew I had a place to turn. There was God spoke to me, and I locked myself in my room one day with a bunch of Al-Anon literature, Al-Anon and Alateen literature, and I just read. I read for like 24, 48 hours, something like that. One of the books I loved the most was The Dilemma of the Alcoholic Marriage. I am not married. I am not married to an alcoholic, but I loved that one. It talked about what it meant to love somebody. What does it mean to love somebody in a healthy way? What does it mean to have courtesy in a relationship? What does it mean to have boundaries? Things like that. I didn't understand boundaries. I thought I didn't have any. I took pride in not having any boundaries. You know, we talk about about I have these chaotic feelings on the inside, self-centeredness, insecurity, feeling that I'm not supposed to be here, and I don't feel the ease and comfort when I take a drink. That's not my experience. I feel that ease and comfort when somebody says, "Hey, where is so and so? You're the only one who knows where they are. You know, how is so and so doing? You're the only one who knows how they're feeling. You know, are you taking care of this person?" It's the feeling that I get when my boss tells me, "You're the only one I can trust here." That's where I feel that sense of ease and comfort, is thinking that, you know, I am taking care of someone, or I am meaningful to someone because they're giving me praise, or whatever it may be, when I'm changing myself to fit the mold that I think somebody else wants. That's where I feel that. But also immediately afterwards, I no longer feel it anymore. It slips away just as fast as it comes in. And then I'm left with this anxiety, left with this pit in my stomach that I'm not supposed to be here. But I, in that 24 to 48 hours, I had a spiritual awakening. It was a rock bottom, and I realized that my higher power has been walking with me the entire time. That God that I come to understand as existing, maybe cares about me, that God had been walking with me the entire time. I thought about times when I was a child that no person, no human being was taking care of me. There was neglect in my household. No human being was taking care of me, and yet there was something that was taking care of me because I was still here. And that power, I could trust that power. My idea of a higher power was just that there is something else in this universe that is on my side. There is something else out there that I can trust, that I can rely on, that I'm not alone. That I am not alone because there is a higher power. That's what God is to me, is that I am not alone. And I could rely on that. I could build a foundation on that. So after that, I went back into my steps. It was kind of my perfect step seven, because I had spent 7 years becoming entirely ready to have my character defects removed. I was sick of them. And at that point, I didn't care if there was nothing left. I wanted my higher power to take away these things that had ruined a life I wanted to build. I wanted my higher power to take those away, and I was ready for anything that filled that space. And fortunately for me, the God of my understanding takes away those character defects and in their place puts in things that I never thought I was capable of. I was able to have a life that I never thought I was capable of. I assumed I was doomed to be either my mother or my father. Those were my options. And instead, I can be something completely different than the alcoholism I experienced. So I moved on from my step 7, jumped into my step 8, which is a heck of a step to jump in on after 7 years. But I had some amends to make. So it was really helpful. The top of my list were people who I was like, it'll be cold days in somewhere when I'm able to make amends to this person. I'm never doing it. It's never happening. And as soon as I got home from meeting with my sponsor to go over my step 8 list, that person was at my house. And they had just gotten done doing their 8th step with their sponsor, because I brought this person to the program, right? I like dated them, and then I was like, I can fix you, and I brought them into the program. I don't recommend that, but whatever. We ended up, we had both done our step 8, and we sat down in my parents' bedroom, and we did our step 9 amends, and I wanted the earth to open up and swallow me whole. I was mortified. I thought that nothing was going to be lower than this point when I had to make amends to this person, but you know what? I lived. And it's wonderful, because if I came across this person, I have no guilt or shame in me. I was freed of guilt and shame. I never thought I would have freedom from guilt or shame. I thought I was going to carry those forever. I thought that guilt and shame taught me how to be a better person. They don't. They just keep me in the past. They keep me from being free of that and becoming a better person, because it makes me feel like I am always going to be my actions in the past. Every step 9 amends after that was easier. Everything was easier than that. But it helped me to be free. That idea of being happy, joyous, and free. I was like, this is where the freedom takes place. My step 10, 11, 12, they call those maintenance steps or growth steps. I love growth steps, because those keep me going. If I really had peaked at 17, that would be rough. I needed to be able to grow. I went back and I did my steps 1 through 5 again shortly after that, because it had been a while, so I needed to do that, and did an inventory that was the most thorough inventory I had ever done. And I had an understanding of myself at that point that I had never had. I was able to be honest with myself, be extremely, barrenly honest with myself. And that was priceless. I never thought I would be able to get that. At the end, I asked my sponsor, so what now? Cool, I know myself a little bit. I don't know how to deal with the world. I don't know how to do any of this. And so we started working the traditions of Al-Anon. And that taught me how to interact with other people. It taught me how to have relationships with other people. Because I didn't have a rule book. I felt that everybody else had gotten the guidebook and I had not. I thought that everybody else knew the rules of how they were supposed to interact with other people and not screw things up, not take advantage of other people, not create chaos wherever they went. And I didn't know how to do that. But the traditions taught me how to do that. The traditions that keep the recovery rooms going and that we're not constantly in chaos. I mean, okay. You get a bunch of Al-Anons together. Like, alcoholics, you can be sober and, like, you get a little bit more reasonable. Al-Anons, we have none of that, right? So we're just in a... You get a bunch of crazy people in the same room together, and you would think it gets worse, but somehow it gets better. How does that happen? It happens because of the traditions. And so if me, crazy person, can go out in the world and interact with people using those same rules, maybe I won't create more rooms of crazy people. And so I have a workshop later if you guys want to come to it. It's about living legacies, where I talk more about the traditions and concepts, which is where the meat of it was for me. The traditions and the concepts of service, those taught me what it is to have a place in the world, what it is to interact with other people, to not feel alone, to feel like I'm one of many, to understand unity, to understand boundaries. What are boundaries? What do I have as boundaries? Why do I feel the ways that I feel? How do I express to people, hey, I felt this way when this happened. What can we do to work on that? What is it to have a group conscience in my relationships? What is it to be balanced and to have a sense of autonomy, to allow others to make their own decisions and for me to be able to make my own decisions without having to check, hey, are you okay if I do this? Even though it has nothing to do with that person, without having to do things in secret so that nobody knows that I did it in case that the consequences are not something that they want to have happen. I don't have to do those things anymore. I don't have to sneak around or manipulate in order to feel like I deserve to be somewhere. Because of the tools of the traditions and the concepts, they have worked wonders in my family. My mother and I have both had the opportunity to work the traditions and the concepts. I need to follow up on... Sometimes I forget to include anything after my mom just being abusive when I was a kid. My mother and I are best friends now. My mother is here with me this weekend, and I'm really grateful for that. My mother's not on a pedestal to me anymore. My mother and I we have a relationship of equals. We have a very loving, unconditionally loving relationship that is only because of the program of Al-Anon. It is only because we have been here and we were able to heal. I can't tell you exactly how that healing process worked. We did a lot of hard work. I don't remember exactly what the hard work was, but we did a lot of hard work. There were times that I was not able to have her physically touch me because I couldn't deal with that. I was emotionally damaged from what had happened, and I wasn't able to do that. Now I can. It's gotten better. We were able to heal and grow from that. And there's a level of when you come from... when you come from the pits, when you come from chaos, and you've seen rock bottom together, it can only go up. There are things, we can share anything with each other because anything is better than where we came from. You know, I don't think that there's anything I could tell her that would be really more shocking than what we've already gone through. And so we trust one another. And that's a gift, to be able to trust one another. Not only to trust a person, which I thought I would never be able to do, but to be able to trust somebody who had hurt me in the past significantly, but now we have a relationship of love. The program has impacted every single area of my life, and I do want to share when I was a kid, as far back as I can remember, I was not born a boy, and maybe on the inside, but I didn't know what to do with that. And when I was a teenager, I found a word for that, and I found out that I could transition and live life as a man. And I was terrified that a lot of trans kids get kicked out by their parents when they tell them that. The rate of suicide in trans teens is 50%, and I was almost part of that percentage. And when I told my mother, I didn't know what her reaction was going to be. I didn't know if she was going to kick me out, if she was going to tell me that I was no longer a part of the family. And because of this program, that sounds kind of hokey, but because of this program, we were able to work through that. Because of Tradition 10 in Al-Anon that says that we have no opinion on outside issues, my identity was an outside issue to her. She just loved me. And having that support, when we have a relationship that's based on going through terrible times together, I could rely on her at a time that I couldn't rely on anybody else. I was the first person at my school to ever be trans. I dealt with bullying and other, you know, legal issues and things like that. And I was able to rely on somebody in my family who loved me. And I wouldn't have had that resource if it weren't for the rooms. In addition to that, when I went on hormones, I did go on hormones. This didn't just like happen because I was hoping for it. I did go on hormones, and one of the things they don't tell you is that when you take testosterone, you get really angry all the time. You get really angry, and you get really irrational, and I started driving at like 70 miles an hour at a 35, and I didn't want to ask anybody for directions anymore. I didn't know how to be compassionate. I didn't know how to, like, listen to people and, like, respect what they had to say. Like, it was awful. And I asked my doctor, I was like, why do I feel like this? And he was like, that's just being a guy. And I was like, I don't like that. And I was like, well, what does it mean to be a guy and not be like that? Well, I found guys in the rooms that were not like that. I found guys in Al-Anon and in Alcoholics Anonymous who were not like that. I found guys who were compassionate and who had patience and who did not drive 70 miles an hour in a 35, who were responsible, who were able to listen to other people and be able to share with them in a mature way. And I said, I want to be like that. And so I studied these guys in Al-Anon. I asked them, how did they get where they were? And it was through the tools of this program. I looked at how the traditions affect the ways that I speak and listen to other people and the ways that I interpret my fellow human beings and my actions, being able to take responsibility for my actions. And as a result, I'm able to be a man that I'm proud of today because of this program and because of the things that I learned here and because of the people I've met in the fellowship and who I've learned I had the capacity to be. I am now a person standing here today that I never would have thought I would be. I never thought, A, that I would be here. I assumed I was going to die at 21. I assumed as far back as I can remember, I'm not living past 21. I don't know why, I don't know how, I don't know if it's going to be me or somebody else. I mouthed off to somebody when I didn't need to, but I'm not going to be here after 21. When I turned 22, it was pretty crazy. I'm 23 now. I don't really know what to do with this, but this is bonus time. This is bonus time I didn't think I would have. I didn't think I would be here, and now I'm living a life that I never thought I would be able to because of recovery. I get to be something that is not either my mother or my father, but something entirely different. I get to be able to change this cycle of alcoholism that had continued in our family generation after generation after generation. I don't need to perpetuate it when I have a family of my own. I don't have to continue these patterns of finding other people who match those dysfunctional, the rocks in my head matching the holes in theirs. I don't have to do that anymore. I have tools now. I have faith. I have a rock solid faith that anything that happens in my life, I have a higher power that will carry me through it. I have a higher power that will walk with me, and I have other, you know, people in recovery. I have wonderful, loving people in my life now who will be able to walk with me. I'm not afraid of what my actions are or what other people's actions are anymore. At least not that constant fear. Sometimes it does creep back. Of course, it always creeps back sometimes. But I don't have to live in fear. I don't have to live in fear. I can live in faith. We have a set of it's not allowed to be called the Al-Anon promises anymore because we don't make promises. I don't know why AA is able to make promises, but we're not able to make promises. I don't know why that is, but we're not allowed to call them promises anymore. It's just like a passage in From Survival to Recovery on page 267. I don't know if it's 267. But there's a passage, and it talks about the things that we may unlock when we practice this program to the best of our ability. And one of there are several of those. One of those is we laugh more, which I always love. I'm able to laugh more now. How wonderful of a gift is that, to be able to experience the joy of life? Anyway, and we risk new things, risk new talents that we previously wouldn't have been able to. There are a lot of things, but one of those is that it's a process, a constant evolution toward wholeness. I felt incomplete constantly, and I feel whole today. I'm not done. I'm constantly growing. I should hope I'm not done at 23. That would really be boring for the rest of life. But I am evolving towards wholeness. You know, I have the capacity for wholeness now. I don't have to walk around feeling like I need somebody to fill that or that I'm just going to be a little empty all the time. This program has afforded me the opportunity to, it taught me how to be a kid, taught me how to have a childhood. My sponsor tells me it's never too late to have a happy childhood. I was able to go back and experience some things about childhood that I wasn't able to when I was a kid. It taught me how to have a childhood. It taught me how to be an adult. I transitioned to Al-Anon when I was about 17. I missed that part. But when I had my, like, spiritual awakening thing that happened, I transitioned to Al-Anon. They had bigger words, and that appealed to me at the time. And as I started going to meetings more and more, people talked about what they felt like on the inside. And that's been a gift. It taught me how to be an adult. It taught me how to be a man. It taught me how to interact with my fellow human beings. And above all else, it taught me how to be a child of God. It taught me how to trust that there is a power greater than myself that is taking care of everything, that is taking care of me, that is taking care of you, that is holding all of us, you know, in the palm of his hand. And I can rely on that. And I'm very grateful to be here today. Thank you.
so glad you did that.